Hello again. This is Carol Bond returning with the Decatur Herald Review, dated June 9th. We'll continue with the Dear Abby articles or comments that we were reading prior to our break. These are in response to a question about how to reply to strangers who comment on your biracial children. Dear Abby, 30 years ago, we adopted two baby girls of a different race from ours. Our adoption social worker gave us some insightful advice about what to do when someone made a bigoted or ignorant remark. She said, "Always remember your child is watching you to see how she is supposed to feel about what has just happened. If you become upset and defensive, your children will feel that way too and begin to believe something is wrong about them and your family. So take the role of teacher and educate the ignorant person. Keep it light, add humor if you can, and then chuckle later with your child and other family members about the silly dumbness of a few people in the world. It worked for us," and that's signed Antonia, mother of two. Here's another letter. "Dear Abby, when my adopted son from Bogota, Colombia was about 4 months old, we were shopping for groceries one day. A woman approached our cart and asked, 'Where is he from?' I smiled and replied, 'Heaven.'" That's signed by Kathy in New York. "Dear Abby, I employ a strategy I learned from your column. I face the questioner with a smile and say, 'I am stunned that you would ask such a personal thing.' The look on the asker's face is priceless, and it makes it quite clear that I have no obligation to respond to anything someone may choose to ask. To that mother, hold your head high, radiate pride in your precious child, and know all's right in your world." That's signed Pat in the Northwest. Another one. "Dear Abby, I have a wonderful grandchild of mixed race. When I'm asked insensitive questions like, 'What is he?' I smile, hold him close, and respond, 'He's perfect, don't you think?' Proud Gran in South Carolina." Here's a free feature article about gardening. This is written by Dean Fosdick of the Associated Press. "We can all help pollinators one flower pot at a time. Even a little effort, a potted plant, say, on an apartment balcony, can mean a lot when trying to help restore declining pollinator populations like bees, bats, and butterflies. Every contribution is worthwhile," said Victoria Wojcik, research director for the Pollinator Partnership in Toronto, Ontario. "You're making a better environment for pollinators, no matter how small. Butterflies and other pollinators don't need large areas for foraging, but they do need a flower," she said. "A planter on a balcony, even on the 30th floor, they will find it and visit it," she said. "If people do this all over the city, it will definitely help. Pollination is needed by at least 80% of the world's crop species. Wind does the job for numerous plants, notably grasses, while many others are served by a variety of animal pollinators. Both sides benefit. Wildlife feed on the pollen and flower syrup while helping their plant partners reproduce. But changing land use, viruses and pesticides are being blamed for massive pollinator losses, especially among the 4,000 native bee species in the United States and the thousands of managed stocks of non-native honeybees. Enter pollinator planting. Native plants attract native pollinator species," said Carrie Houle, an extension educator with the University of Illinois. Know which are suitable for your growing zone. Find a beneficial fit. She suggests a number of pollinator-friendly annuals for container use. Alyssum, Cleom, Flax, Lantana, Snapdragon, and Zinnia among them. Select different flower sizes and shapes to match pollinator feeding habits. Butterflies like places to sit, Wojcik said. Hummingbirds like bugle-shaped plants. Fragrant, sweet-smelling flowers attract night-flying creatures like bats and moths. Certain flower colors are pollinator magnets. Bees seem to like bright whites and yellows, while butterflies appear drawn to reds and purples. Here are more tips for attracting pollinators to pots. Use succession planting to provide pollen and nectar from early spring to late fall. Spring is an important season, especially for overwintering honeybees, because their food stocks of honey are low and spring blooming flowers are harder to find. That could mean tolerating dandelions, a favorite pollen source. Place containers in full sun and shelter them from high winds. Include water in the menu by adding a bird bath or dripping faucet. Provide host plants like milkweed that are popular with monarch butterfly larvae. Stop using pesticides. You may see a little damage to some of your plants, but eliminating chemicals will greatly benefit pollinators, Wojcik said. Choose double-duty plants, such as colorful edibles. Herbs are a big one, especially rosemary and chives, Wojcik said. Fruit trees can be grown in patio planters, but their production is limited. Get them into the ground before they become root-bound. Blueberries and raspberries deliver sizable crops in containers, but need protection from killing frosts in winter. Vegetables do extremely well in pots, particularly cucumbers and tomatoes, Wojcik said. Bumblebees love gathering pollen from tomatoes. They're uniquely adapted to that. Our next article is called Remembering Easy Tips Can Help with Memory, and this was written by Chelsea Byers. She is an Illinois Extension employee on family life-related topics. This month, I would like to feature an article from my fellow family life educator, Molly Hofer. Molly and I are both very interested in brain health and brain research. She has recently written this article about prospective memory. I must remember to call my grandson tomorrow to wish him a happy birthday, drop off the dry cleaning before work, pay the electric bill by Friday, lock the front door at night, pick up my daughter at the airport on Tuesday at noon. Each of us can relate to these everyday demands where we need to rely on our ability to remember something we intend to do in the future. This is called prospective memory. Quite simply, it is not forgetting to remember. While research varies as to whether prospective memory ability is impacted by aging, it is clear that every one of us at any age forgets sometimes. Forgetting to bring dessert to a dinner party can be embarrassing, but typically harmless, unless you can't live without chocolate. Some prospective memory failures, however, can be dangerous, like neglecting to turn the stove off, leaving for work, and forgetting the dog is outside all day, or not remembering to take a much-needed medication. Prospective memory differs from retrospective memory, which is memory for past events or learned information. To put it simply, forgetting the name of a childhood friend, is a retrospective memory fail. While not remembering to pick up your grandson from T-ball practice is a prospective memory fail. Prospective memory tasks are typically time-based or event-based. Time-based tasks are those that are done at a particular time, like meeting a friend at 8 or checking on the cake in the oven after 30 minutes. Event-based tasks are things we remember to do when an event occurs. An example of this would be remembering that you need to get milk and bread when you see a grocery store. Because there are so many times in our daily lives where we need to remember an intended action, it shouldn't seem surprising that we sometimes, like jugglers, drop a ball or two and forget to do things. So how can we make it better? How do we work at remembering future tasks? Here are some suggestions to try. Write it down. If you've ever said, "If I don't write this down, I'll never remember," you are not alone. It sounds very simple, but giving yourself written reminders can really help you remember. Use a calendar or keep a notepad to jot yourself reminder notes. But do note that written reminders are only as good as the person who looks at those reminders. Don't put it off. If you say things like, "I'll make that phone call after this movie ends," chances are you may forget. If you think of something you need to do and have the time right then, don't put it off. Create tangible clues. Make a powerful change in your surroundings or leave a visual clue as a prompt to remember later. For example, put the library book you need to return at the front door, or place a sticky note on the bathroom mirror. Someone told me he puts his car keys in the refrigerator at night in order to remember to take his lunch to work the next day. Control your stress. When you are mentally stressed by all of the things you need to remember or do, or if you are worried or anxious, you can forget something. You can even become distracted by your own thoughts. Taking time to work on relaxation in a way that benefits you is important. Also important is to, again, write down what you need to remember. Make a letter string. If you are, for instance, getting ready for a trip and you have a few items you want to remember to put into your suitcase but are not able to at the time, take the first letter of the name of each item and string them together. As an example, if you want to make sure you pack your camera, toothbrush, belt, and scarf, you would string the letters C, T, B, S. If you keep saying C, T, B, S over and over every once in a while in your mind, you will thus remember those items. I hope that you found Molly's article and information helpful to better understand prospective memory, as well as possibly try some of her suggestions to help aid in remembering things that you need to do in the future. We're going to continue with this article. This is written by Julie Worth, and this was in today's News Gazette from Champaign. And her main heading is this, Sand Sun in the Midwest. Her column is called, Are We There Yet? Headline, Lake Michigan Dunes Offer Quick, Easy Getaway Near Champaign-Urbana. Summer has just started by the school calendar, if not the actual calendar, and we've already checked one item off my daughter's vacation bucket list, a beach road trip. It wasn't a drive 2 days to get to the ocean beach vacation, although I am always open to that possibility. It wasn't even a weekend getaway. This was more of a mini midweek beach trip. A little over 2 hours from Champaign is the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and we are lucky enough to be related to someone who knows someone who owns a house right on the beach. My sister-in-law was able to reserve it last week, but we had to squeeze in our trip between the end of school on Tuesday and a doctor's appointment, play audition, and baseball games on Friday and Saturday, and work, of course. So we drove up Wednesday and drove back home Thursday night. It may not sound like much, but the weather was sunny, the company was great, and we made every minute count. The lake house is nothing fancy. It's more of a cabin, really, started in the early 1900s by a family patriarch who dragged the building materials a half mile up the beach from the only road then available. He left it to his 8 children, who in turn had lots of children, and they all take turns using it during the summer months. The rustic wood walls are covered with paintings and old photos of the house over the years. The location can't be beat. On a clear day, you can see the Chicago skyline. The Indiana Dunes State Park, where you can climb the giant sand hills formed by ancient glacial lakes, is a short walk down the beach, and the view is breathtaking, as long as you blot out the steel mill and power plant in the distance. I remember the first time I saw the dunes as a young adult and thought, "What are these doing here?" Huge mounds of sand that look like they should be on a beach in North Carolina, sitting just miles from Gary, Indiana. During our first trip to the lake house a couple of years ago, my kids had no idea what to expect. They'd been to Hilton Head the previous summer, and when we came up over a ridge and suddenly saw the dunes and Lake Michigan stretching out before us, they thought they were back at the ocean. We did all the usual beach things on our short trip. We took an evening walk on the cool sand, raced each other up the dunes. Some of us needed to pause a time or two. Tested out the boogie boards and kayaks, skimmed rocks on the water, and built the obligatory sand castle and moat to capture the tide. Rather than shells, we hunted for rocks along the shore, an interesting mix of scarlet, green, blue-gray, and gold pebbles and bits of beach glass. Mixed in with them were tiny Cheerio-shaped beads, the fossils of crinoids, plant-like marine animals that thrived in the Midwest hundreds of millions of years ago. We traded the big screen TV at home for a 13-inch portable that was turned on only once for the Blackhawks playoff game. We put our phones down, mostly, and played poker and blitz and crazy card games our relatives invented. And we hit our favorite restaurant in Porter, Indiana, appropriately named The Port, a drive-in, dine-in joint known for its creamy homemade root beer, coleslaw, chili dogs, milkshakes, and fried clams, in all capital letters, and fried corn. To me, nothing is more relaxing than spending a week at the ocean with family, digging my toes into the warm sand and falling asleep to the whoosh of the waves against the shore. But the ocean is far away. This is as good as it gets in the Midwest. Even this short jaunt was enough to make us forget life's stresses for a little while. Medicine for the soul. I used to wait for the weekend or scheduled vacations for these escapes. My husband, a sports writer who was often busy on weekends, has taught me not to wait to have fun. So here's to midweek getaways and a busy summer bucket list. After writing a column 2 weeks ago about Weiss Lancaster's futile efforts to save the house he grew up in 403 West University Avenue, Champaign, this is still Julie Worth writing at the end of her column. After writing that column, I heard from realtor Andrea Polik, the listing agent for the house. She wanted to add a few details and correct a few others. Polik said the house was rehabbed some years ago by contractor Ron Meister, who sold it to another buyer for $203,000 in 2004. The house was rented by students who apparently didn't treat it well, and later went into foreclosure, she said. It fell into disrepair when a hole in the roof went unrepaired, and it rained inside the house for 2 years, she said. Polik said the sale was handled by Fannie Mae, not the Department of Housing and Urban Development. She initially received 4 to 6 offers for the house, including Lancaster's, but a Fannie Mae official pulled the listing temporarily because it had been put on the market before it was cleaned out, not because of the mold, she said. A crew was brought in to remove the debris, and it was listed again. She received 4 offers the second time, including the winning bid of $100,000. Aside from Lancaster, every single person who looked at it was going to tear it down, said Polik, who has extensive photos of mold-covered walls and holes in the walls and floors. Here's an article by another favorite columnist. Houseworks. There is always too many somethings to do. It never rains, but it pours, they say. For about 2 weeks this spring, I was casting about for something to keep me busy in the shop while it was doing just that outside. I swept up a winter's worth of sawdust. I polished my handsaws. I dug all the gunk out of the gears in my table saw that had been preventing me from making true 90-degree cuts. I sorted through the burgeoning collection of hardware and other metallic litter that pile up despite my best intentions. I can't seem to part with it. I even took down the screen door out front and hauled it to the shop for completely unnecessary refurbishing. Then, just as the skies were clearing and I finally could tackle the gardens in earnest, all manner of projects came my way. The little tea box was my own fault, really. My buddy and I had a 5 years since we met anniversary coming up, and the traditional gift on such a momentous occasion is wood. Pretty much played into my strong suit. I thought of doing a carving for her, but Mindy already has one. Same for the puzzle boxes. In fact, even her kids have my puzzle boxes. So because she's a caffeine addict, I made her a little wooden box to keep her tea in. I was in the midst of carving tea into the lid, so Mindy wouldn't mistakenly fill it with garlic or rusty nails, I suppose, when my neighbor John showed up at the shop door with an order for ammo boxes. I've been making the rustic little boxes for the past 3 years as rewards for young sharpshooters. They're actually shadow boxes, sized to hold the cartons that shotgun shells come in and other dead-eye paraphernalia. I assume the graduating seniors who get them then graduate to meatier targets than clay pigeons. Making the ammo boxes is simple. But then he told me the awards banquet was just 2 weeks off. Oh, and you don't have to worry about getting that stuff done, John said, pointing at the 4-foot length of diamond willow that was lying on the workbench, ready to be made into a staff. He'd been whittling and sanding it for nearly a year, carefully gouging out the dozens of cankers for which that scrub tree is valued by the owners of canes and walking sticks, before he turned it over to me for finishing. John wanted to add it to his own large collection of canes. Three such pressing shop projects wouldn't have been an issue just a couple of weeks earlier when I was bored silly and would have welcomed anything to play with. But it also was eve of planting season. Here in my corner of the great American desert, the frost-free date is May 10th. That's when you can safely plunk your tomatoes and peppers into the ground, when you can seed your cucumbers and annual flowers, when frost-sensitive summer bulbs can be planted. I had all of that to do, as well as a house to clean, laundry to do, lawns to mow, and a front screen door to paint and rehang. You thought I'd forgotten that, didn't you? So the anniversary was coming May 7th. Planting day was May 10th. The Young Gun Nuts Banquet was May 15th. Did I make it? Frankly, it's a wonder I don't have ulcers. Tim Kane, H&R Entertainment editor, has this. Scott Englund coming up on American Pickers. One of the things I enjoyed about being acquainted with Scott Englund when he was in Decatur as a reporter with WAND-TV is there was always something about him I didn't know previously. He did a Weird Al Yankovic compression act? You bet. He had an interest in running for political office? Yep. He was actually willing to allow himself to be tased on camera? He sure did. And now he reports he'll be featured on American Pickers on the History Channel at 8 p.m. Wednesday, June 10th. England lives in Hendersonville, Tennessee, with his wife and daughter. He works for the Ernest Tubb Record Shops and is assisting on country artist Ronnie McDowell's autobiography, which he hopes to have published by Christmas. England wrote his own news release about the appearance, among its highlights. You know you have way too much stuff when the American Pickers knock on your door. The appearance will spotlight his collection of Evel Knievel memorabilia. I was friends with Evel for the last 20 years of his life. At one time, I had one of the world's biggest Evel Knievel collections. After Evel died, I ended up with a lot of his personal items. His collection included Knievel's pajamas, his last motorcycle riding boots, eyeglasses, and even his oxygen tank. I also ended up with all of Evel's fan mail. I have thousands of letters that he didn't get to open, and I have left it just the way it was when he died. I never opened any of it. The Pickers were also interested in some of England's country music memorabilia. Much was gathered when England worked in radio. I have a unique country collection. I like to collect weird things. I have Loretta Lynn's toaster that she autographed. She wrote, "Me and Dew, her husband, had this a long time." How many people can say they have Loretta Lynn's toaster? Well, it's about 3 p.m. This has been Carol Bond with the Decatur Herald Review, dated June 9th, 2015. I look forward to reading with you again.